Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome. My name is Michael Johnston, and this is a new episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. And today I have Dr. George Musgrave on to discuss his book, Can Music Make You Sick? Measuring the Price of Musical Ambition, which he co-authored with Sally Ann Gross. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Musgrave.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And let's get right to it. What led you to this to writing this book and conducting the research for this book?
Well, really, it was a coming together of the research interests of myself and Sally Ann Gross, who I wrote the book with. As you just said in the introduction there, before I started my lectureship, when I was finishing my PhD, I was trying to think what my kind of next major research project was going to be, building on the themes that I'd explored in the PhD, which was about, as you just said, competition, how competition is experienced, what it feels like as a kind of behavioral and psychological phenomenon, basically. And when I met Sally, and I actually met Sally through Making Music, her son was producing a record and he produced it and I was rapping on it. When I met her, she had told me that for years she'd been thinking about changing working conditions, what that meant for musicians, drawing on her time running the masters, but also she's a music manager and has worked in the music industry for about 30 years. And she said, I've got this project idea. I've got this title, Can Music Make You Sick? And people are not really taking it that seriously. Like, I keep running into a brick wall about it. People think that all artists are a bit mad, so maybe it's not really a proper research project. And I remember saying to her, no, I think that sounds amazing. Like, we should, because I had emotional themes as part of my PhD. And so we kind of came together with my kind of research background and ideas of competitiveness, along with her music industry experience and basically this title which she'd come up with, which kind of drove it forward. So it was a real, like, kind of meeting of minds, I suppose.
Yeah. So one of the key components of this article, I think, was the difference between well-being and mental health. A key distinguishing concept between the psychology and the sociology. So as you were approaching this, I think maybe you had mental health and well-being in mind. Is that true? And
yeah.
I guess maybe distinguishing between the two.
Absolutely. And also trying to look at well-being and mental health from our kind of disciplinary perspective, because of course, like, we're not psychologists and we're not medical clinicians. What we're interested is in working conditions and the workplace within which, you know, musicians find themselves. And so we're kind of exploring the difference between the two. And I suppose one of the differences is that, you know, well-being is a kind of more general catch-all term, and it includes, like, an individual's their internal state, but also external factors, right, that could contribute towards flourishing or feelings of happiness or contentment and things. Whereas mental health is relating more specifically to kind of psychological states. So you have the WHO, who kind of define well-being as being like a state where everyone can realize their potential, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and can make a contribution to their community. The quote is something like that. So you have well-being as containing these kind of external drivers, external circumstances, but also internal psychological factors that kind of impact the lives of individuals and stuff. So well-being is kind of this societal goal, right, that you're trying to achieve for the kind of overall improvement in people's lives. And kind of it's become a real political descriptor, right? You see it in the work of people like my colleague at Goldsmiths called Will Davies, who's done a lot of work on this. Whereas obviously mental health is more specifically about the individual and their state of mind. And well-being has an individual's external social position. But what was interesting throughout a lot of the literature on both mental health and well-being is you find references to like positive thinking, right? The importance of positive thinking, and that the centrality of positive thinking is one of the things that makes researching well-being and mental health within the music industries almost like a bit taboo, because the music industries are all about this kind of techno-positivist mantra of staying positive. So looking at what it's like when that's not the case is interesting, at least. And what we basically argue in the book is that when it comes to understanding well-being and mental health, what matters, what matters in a kind of methodological sense, is what people say, right? How people say they are feeling. So how people perceive their life is going from their perspective, right? That's a quote from someone that we use in the book. And so the suggestion is that in an environment of kind of terminological imprecision, what really matters is what the subject says, right? The person's relative perspective. So that's what drove our method, basically, right? Like taking people's self-assessment seriously as being indicative of their relative mental state, and it's not a clinical diagnosis. So that trying to disentangle that distinction between well-being and between mental health is kind of what led us to our method, right? That it's about how people perceive it and listening to them, and when they tell you how they perceive it, listening to it and taking that seriously, basically.
So in this sense, you start to take into consideration the social or the environmental factors that have influence on the well-being or the state of well-being that participants had. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, that's exactly right. And we draw a lot on the work of Smail and say that, you know, whilst we don't deny the kind of individual factors, people's backgrounds and things like that, you know, what we are trying to do is to try and say, like, we are trying to bring in those environmental factors and take those environmental factors seriously as a way of understanding how people see the world, right? So understanding what Smail argues, right, is that for an understanding of an individual's total circumstances, which includes their exterior world. So what we draw on is that idea that you have to look both outward and inward, right, from the person to their environment, which is material, right, and to understand that material environment. Yeah.
Kind of looking at the looking glass self, the taking in and readjusting, determining on what one sees their identity as being. And in this particular, looking at the music world and participants of it.
Right. Exactly.
And that leads maybe to the next question. Music is not the same today as it was yesterday in the sense of how it is provided and how it is distributed. How has this change in distribution of music changed the platform and how we as an audience listen to music, or how it is performed by the actors?
Right. I mean, it's a big question, and it's one that drives a lot of the kind of early discussion in the book, right? Understanding, and we return to it at the end as well. It kind of top and tails the book, I suppose, but this idea that those distributory mechanisms of music has changed. And that's like one of the key people that we use when we start to think about this is Angela McRobbie. And there's a quote that we use in the book that's hers, and it's from 20 years ago. It's from 1999. And the quote is something like, you know, nobody has asked how much art or music or fashion we can actually accommodate. And she says, how many cultural workers can there be? So what we're doing in the book is to try and say, like, what happens when everyone is making art, when art is everywhere, right? There's never been a time before where we've thought that everyone could make art, right? It used to be special and in special places made by special people. And now you have ideas that, like, you know, we're all artists now, right? Or like David Bowie saying that music would be like running water or would be like electricity. And even when you think of the word streaming, right, that implies a certain infinity and a kind of endlessness. So that idea of the change in the distribution of music for us, our analysis centers around this term of abundance. And so like music today is like special and everywhere, right? It's like unique and it's abundant. And abundance in terms of this distribution of music, it's a really key term because like outside of the sphere of economics, for example, you like abundance is a good thing, right? You say like, oh, we've got an abundance of fruit, or, you know, there's an abundance of opportunities or something. There's a kind of normative implication, right, that it's good. But there's also like abundance also implies excess, and excess can create waste, and excess can give rise to problems like in a marketplace. And like neoclassical economics shows what those problems are, right? Like diminishment in profit and suboptimal outcomes. What we wanted to look at was like looking at kind of psychological suboptimal outcomes, I suppose, of that abundance, abundant production. And like you could look at this and you could look at that question another way as well, right? That as listeners, as people that listen to music, like we all do, our relationship due to the distribution of music has been completely transformed, right? Because it's everywhere and the way we interact with it has changed. So music always has always had uses, right? Like people construct their identity through music or whatever. But today you find that music consumption has become this kind of private, individualized thing where you have playlists to study to, or playlists to do yoga to, or playlists to go to sleep to, or playlists to have a bath to, right? Music has a certain utility that means that the listener's relationship to music has changed. And what we were saying is that if this shift, if it's changed for the way consumers use music, it must have changed for the producers too, and the way that they produce it. And the focus is often on the consumers. And we wanted to move the focus to producers and say, like, what does it mean to be a music maker when music is everywhere? And I suppose that the argument that we try and develop is that we draw on Keith Negus's idea in the book that now being a musician has changed. And what the way Keith Negus describes it is he says like that musicians have changed from being like a creator of a product and now they're a curator of content, right? Music isn't art anymore. Music is data, like networked data. And so we are saying that that must have repercussions for the people that produce it. Like that has to have implications, sorry, for the people that produce it. And that's really what we're looking at.
Yeah, and that implication that it has, or consequence that it has on the producer, lies in the areas of work, value, and relationships that are mutually reinforcing more than mutually exclusive, I think, in your study, and seeing how the producers work and what their values are and their relationships with the music and their audiences. Is that right?
Yeah, right. And so the three features that you've just mentioned there are the kind of three, they're the three kind of central chapters in the book in which we explore these kind of three main features of musical work that we look at in order to explore the ways in which having musical ambition, I suppose, seeking to build a musical career, comes to harm, I suppose, or like negatively impact the emotional well-being of the musicians making it. And there's a crucial distinction here, which is that a line we sometimes use when we're talking about the book is that making music is therapeutic, but making a career out of music is traumatic. And I suppose that's the thing we look at, and the way in which building that career is traumatic is through those three features which you've just outlined. And we call them statuses. And we call it, we have the first one is called the status of work, which is where we look at the way in which musical work, how music understood through the prism of employment, what that work is and how that work is experienced has changed. So that's kind of the economic. Then we also look at the cultural, which is what we call the status of value. So the status of value is sort of the ways in which musicians evaluate their creative labor, kind of online and in the music industry, the ramifications that has for how they communicate, the nature of this evaluation, things like that. And then the third factor is, like you said, the social, and which that status we call the status of relationships. So the ways in which musical labor comes to occupy and consume the lives of the musicians making it and destabilizes the relationships of those around them. Those are the kind of three main chapters in the book, basically. And you know, within each of those, there's a lot that we could, you know, I'm sure we're going to delineate and discuss. But yeah, though that kind of the economic, the cultural, and the social are the three interrelated features that we explore in the book, really. Those are our kind of findings.
Yes, and I guess the first part to dive into then is the work piece, the economic piece. What did labor look like for musicians? It wasn't simply making music. I think it was much larger than that, particularly when it gets to making a career out of music. The distinguishing characteristic that you just mentioned between making music, which can be therapeutic, but also the career of music, which can become traumatic.
Right. And what we explore in this idea of looking at music as the status of work, the kind of economic, the way in which we understand it, as I say, through the prism of kind of employment, the kind of economic rewards, I suppose, of doing music, is we essentially unpack how music makers engage with a kind of a terminological and a conceptual struggle to define their working practices as labor. And the difficulty in conceptualizing what they do as labor and the kind of problems that all leads to. So, I mean, I can dive into that a little bit. So, like, musical work is, of course, it's like making music, but of course it's much more than that. And as I mentioned in the previous sentence, they're kind of curators of content that are kind of must always be online, because everything that they do is potentially an opportunity to like engage with their fan base or whatever. And people are doing a real wide range of things, like writing the music, recording it, performing it, obviously, but then a whole wide range of other things too, whether it's organizing tours or developing a kind of whole infrastructure around themselves, like developing themselves as kind of like a brand, I suppose, and being entrepreneurial in that respect. And I know lots of musicians might be kind of reticent to use the term entrepreneurial, but many of the people that we spoke to exhibit those characteristics. And I mean, looking at that and saying it's difficult to earn money doing that, which is at its baseline is where we're kind of starting, is not particularly groundbreaking, right? And that's been written about before under this kind of prism of a kind of exceptional economy of the arts, it's been called by Abing, right? That's kind of what he's called it, this idea that it's hard to make money from it. But what we build on in the chapter is this idea that kind of very high level of financial precarity for what one does produces a kind of definitional existential crisis. And that crisis is like, if your labor doesn't earn you money, can you meaningfully refer to it as a job or as a career? So how do you know that your musical work, in fact, is work? And that creates issues both like internally for how the musicians feel about themselves and the work that they're doing. So we spoke to someone who'd performed at Glastonbury and had like many critically acclaimed releases. And in the interview, she said to us, well, she worked in a shop as well. And she said, like, well, I'll meet someone and they'll say, well, what's your job? And she said something like, well, I think I should mention the other stuff that I do because it sounds more valid. You know, maybe it is more valid. So you have that internal struggle, but then you also have the external one as well. So like one of the quotes that people refer to quite a lot in the book is a producer that we emailed who said, you know, I'm sick of people asking me like whether I'm still doing my little music thing. And I'll say, well, yeah, are you still doing your little banking thing? So it's about like how that work is seen. And what's interesting is like that work, because it's considered to be like a pleasure or one that people think that you're kind of lucky to do, that combination of kind of profound attachment to the work you do and absorption in it, which you can see as central in discussions around the expanding service economy or knowledge economy, is that that method of work is kind of inherently like exploitative, right? Because all you need to do is kind of work harder and smile and you know, what you're doing is like a blessing. But that creates issues with the nature of that work. And we build on it in the chapter by saying that what this means is it leads to a number of problems, right? So one of the problems is, how do musicians know they're successful? This is one of the things that we talk about a lot. This idea that, like, you know, if you go on TV, if you go on one of these cooking shows on TV or whatever, and someone tells you, like, oh, the cake you've made sucks, you know, that's a bad cake, then there's some kind of barometer there that you believe them, like, okay, my cake is soggy, like, ergo, my cake hasn't been successful. But of course, in music, it doesn't really work like that, right? There's always this kind of subjective turning inwards whereby you're trying to work out whether what you're doing is successful or not. There's some really extreme challenges in that, trying to work out whether or not you're successful, because we interviewed people, for example, who at the time were like number one in several countries, had just come back from performing in Las Vegas. And, you know, he lives with his mum. Is he successful? There's someone else that we spoke to who'd had a career for 30 years. He's probably not a name that, you know, you or I or our students or whatever would know. But he sells out small venues, and he's made a career out of it for 30 years and supported his family. But he's not going to be, you know, number one anytime soon. Is he successful? These are all things that are very much up for debate in an environment where you're encouraged to be online and convince the world that you are successful, that you appear successful, right? That you're appropriately communicating your cultural capital to others, right? And trying to transubstantiate that into some kind of economic sustainability, which is like increasingly difficult to do. So these are all the questions that are tied up within the status of work, right? What is work? What does that work look like? How is that work successful? And in the end, if that work goes wrong, how do we apportion blame, right? Like, if you believe that this workplace is this kind of open meritocratic environment, we start the chapter with a quote from UK Music who say, like, music is a meritocracy. It's ridiculous. But if you believe that music is a meritocracy, that means that when it goes wrong, that's on you. That's your fault. That's your problem. And these are all factors.
Yes, I think of that with the American dream, maybe a UK dream, meritocracy, the belief that, well, if I try hard, then I will be successful. But that's not always the case, right? It's more complex than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been this idea that music in particular is a form of creative labor that lends itself to social mobility, let's say, in a way that perhaps like fine art doesn't. So you know if you can sing in the shower and, you know, you sound good, then it's okay, you can go on X Factor or America or Britain's Got Talent and stand in a queue, and through the magic, like Clark Kent in the phone box, you can be transformed from, you know, in England, like a boy, a nobody from Cheshire, and suddenly like you're Harry Styles in One Direction, you know. It's been called the digital economy of hope. This is supposed to be one of the things which differentiates music from other forms of art and literature. And there's this idea now, right, that musicians are in control in a way that they never have been before. You see this all the time, this kind of techno-positivist idea that the musicians today have never had it so good, like they're in control. All you need is GarageBand, you know, like you plug in your microphone that you buy for 40 quid from a secondhand shop, record it in GarageBand, and off you go. Like, you can start marketing your music. And this is tied up in this idea that, like, music, like what UK Music had written, that music is a meritocracy. Well, you know, the evidence demonstrates, has been some, you know, books recently on this, has been a book that's just been published called Culture is Bad for You. There were books a few years ago by Mark Banks called Creative Justice. There's plenty of evidence that demonstrates this is just not the case. But the music industries are driven. There's a term that we refer to again over and over again in the book, which is this kind of rhetoric of fantasies. And there's this kind of fantasy in the music industry, like this fantasy of participation, like come and join in. And it's brilliant. Like the more people that join in, the better. Like, let's all live these magnificent creative careers and these creative lives. And it's wonderful. And, you know, the best will rise to the top and that's that. Well, the evidence just doesn't bear that out. You know, it really doesn't. And the reality is much more messy and complicated. And ultimately, in the end, that these, the way that that kind of rhetoric and labor is experienced by musicians emotionally is that it's an incredibly destabilizing place to work. The nature of that work is incredibly destabilizing. And that's where we're kind of building on this idea of precarity, that precarity is more than just a financial reality. It's an emotional state as well. It's a kind of experiential precarity.
And some of the complexity that is dealt with here is the value of social capital and cultural capital that serves some musicians more than others. What value, I guess, then, does social capital and cultural capital serve for these musicians? Does it matter as to who they know and whether or not they become successful?
Right. So that question about social capital and who you know is embedded in, I suppose that really that's really about then what we move on to discuss. Like the next chapter that we're in the book is this one called The Status of Value. So that's like, instead of looking at work through the tradition, through the prism of traditional employment, let's look at instead how validation is kind of sought and obtained for this work. How is kind of meaning derived and understood for this work? And like you say, the discussions of kind of social capital and converting kind of social and cultural capital into one another is central to what we're writing about. So that discussion there, I think, relates a lot to how we understand the ways that musicians seek validation within the music industry. You know, the people that we interviewed refer to it as the music industry, and we know kind of what they mean by the music industry, but of course it's a kind of blurred and kind of amorphous place. What you kind of see in a lot of those discussions and the people that we interviewed and spoke to is they will often talk about things like the role of luck, for example, right? They'll talk about their careers being ruled by a kind of mystical law of luck. So whilst you need like musical talent, family support, connections, hard work, whatever, these are kind of prerequisites, they're kind of given. You need a kind of amount of good luck and randomness and timing and circumstance. And that what you need to do, though, is kind of embed what you're doing within a more powerful structure. So you need to have, you know, a track that has somebody more famous than you on it, because like no one knows who you are. But if you can locate what you're doing within a matrix, an existing power matrix, that gives you a greater chance to be heard, because what you're trying to do is cut through what's been called like the noise of creative ambition. You're trying to embody what your work with a kind of greater perceived level of cultural capital. And that by doing that, you can then cultivate and nurture more robust relationships of kind of social capital. That's basically what a lot of these musicians are really trying to do. And there's this idea that they need to embed what they're doing within a pre-existing power structure, basically, in order to distinguish themselves. I mean, there was a quote that I came across kind of years ago, and I remember thinking, this is just incredible. It sums up so much. And it's a quote called the Babel objection. And it says, when everyone speaks at once, how can anyone be heard? And that sums up a lot of the kind of status of value for musicians, right? There's this idea that emerged particularly like 10 years ago, and it came out of kind of Billboard and Pitchfork and others. So this kind of techno-positivism that says like entrance to the music industry has been completely democratized, right? There's been this transfer of power from a kind of rarefied leviathan of the music industry, that now musicians have been empowered by digital technologies and there's no gatekeepers anymore. And all of that control has completely shifted. And there have been reports recently written about this, and they're titled things like Independent Artists, The Age of Empowerment, right? Or they're called, or you'll see articles online that says the musician's now in control, right? And that therefore you have the tools to to cultivate your kind of social and cultural capital. And like we talked about before, you know, it's on you. Like if you don't make it, that's really on you. And whilst technology has democratized processes of music making and placed a certain level of creative and even distribution power within musicians, and that's been well charted, even so, you still need to understand the kind of power structures of the industry within which you find yourself, right? Many musicians that we spoke to felt that they had a kind of a degree of control, but seeking validation is a kind of complex and messy process that's reliant on networks. So in a world where you have unlimited choice, multiple consumption methods, exponentially increasing supply of music, consumers basically have to find their music somehow. And in order for them to find you, you have to be, or people feel that they have to be, part of this power structure that still relies on people, right? It still relies on, you know, a lot of big Spotify playlists are still curated by people. They're human beings that choose the songs. And for music to get to these people, there's a kind of music ecosystem of musicians and their managers in coffee shops in LA or in London, where they discuss it with the PR agent, gets given to a radio plugger, and they have a conversation at a party, so that then when your song lands in the email inbox of Spotify or Apple, yours gets listened to, because it's a process of kind of networked atomization where gatekeepers and cultural intermediaries do still matter. Making a musical career is a collective endeavor in a highly networked environment. It's a social experience. It's not one that you're just an individual on your own, entirely in control of. You're part of this network infrastructure.
And in the UK, London plays a very big role in this. London is a music centre. Is that correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, and the people that we spoke to, you know, largely did acknowledge that, or they were either fortunate that that was the case because they lived in London, or they resented it because they had to move there. But yeah, I mean, you know, the PRS is here, the musicians manage, you know, the Music Managers Forum is here, all the major record labels are here, all the major publishers are here, the BBC, Radio 1, One Extra, all, you know, it is, you know, London, it is that place that people need to come to.
So alas, there are very few songs that make it popular, though. No matter how many people can make the music and sell it, there are very few musicians who become famous. And even once they do, that infamy may not last very long. What makes for the sticky message?
I mean, that's probably a question that, you know, if people really knew the answer to, then, people would be doing something very different, I suppose. But I mean, that question of what makes a kind of message sticky is one that we try and explore in the book. And I sort of briefly touched on it just before in the previous answer. But, you know, one of the things that you'll find is, like, particularly for up and coming musicians, let's say, and we spoke to a whole wide range of musicians, some who were like, you know, Mercury Prize winners, and some who are just starting doing gigs in small venues. There's this term that John Thompson introduced about 10 years ago, which I really like, which is called recognition triggers. This idea that a song might need a kind of well-known sample or a featured verse from a kind of, like in the UK, for example, like one of the things you find in the UK is, like, if a rapper gets signed to a mate, well, it definitely used to happen every time. I don't know how much it still happens now, but you know, when a rapper got signed to a major label over here, it almost felt like the first thing that they did was like ring French Montana and ask him for like a guest verse on this track, because it's almost like, well, if people don't know who this particular rapper is, like, that's cool. They've probably heard of French Montana, so they can put him on the track so that people see them. And the point is that achieving some level of stickiness, you can try and, you know, you can draw on Malcolm Gladwell's concept of stickiness, and he has this kind of who these people are in order to try and achieve stickiness. You know, what ultimately comes out of it is that trying to do that is imprecise. The idea of stickiness is central to all kind of viral and influencer marketing. But it's hard to really know what that looks like, because of course there is some degree of imprecision in marketing cultural goods like that. And I suppose really the question for me that's almost interesting to kind of flip that question is not to say, how does one achieve stickiness? I think it's more to say, when you understand that trying to achieve stickiness for a cultural product, right, having consumers listen to it, latch on, there's a degree of kind of luck, like a kind of almost like gambling, like record companies are almost gambling on like what's going to work, and you can try and have some control over it. But the question really is like, how much control do musicians really have in this environment, right? When you say, oh, you're an entrepreneur, like you have all the tools in your hand and you know, it's really on you. Like, how much control do you really have over that process? Very little.
Yeah, I think that amount of control is lessened more with the global market, which is maybe an extension of this book and something you can look at in the global market of music and how that has further complicated the music industry.
Yeah, right, for sure. And that's probably another layer that we can try and build on with this, for sure.
So do some of the songs, did you notice that some songs go in and out of circulation with this mass production, mass consumption model of music?
Well, what's interesting is like that idea of kind of removing songs from circulation. Now, in fact, when a new song comes out, you're not just competing with all of the songs that are out at the moment. You're competing with kind of every song that's ever been released ever. So like, for example, I was talking before about the need to like situate your music within a kind of power structure to achieve a connection. Like one of the most lucrative sources of capital for music companies today is heritage acts, catalog acts. So one of the biggest earners last year in 2019 wasn't a new artist, right? It was the Eagles. The Eagles, like famous for Hotel California in the 70s. It's not new music. It's old music. And so there is a sense in which there's so much music being produced and so much music being released. There is some evidence which suggests that there's a degree of kind of small C conservatism in that, you know, when consumers are swamped in like this paradox of choice, you defer to what you already know. And this kind of abundance can encourage kind of conservatism in consumer decision making. So when there's potential for doubt, we're comforted by what we know, not what's new. And so basically like these songs don't go in and out of circulation. They remain in circulation. They used to be able to be taken out, right? You have like deleting stock or whatever. Now you don't. Now you're competing with kind of every song that has ever existed. And that kind of mass, unfathomable, like unimaginable quantity of music that you're competing with is, in a way, it's like, how could this not be impacting the way musicians understand their work? Like the first thing we've talked about, understand the value of what they do, the status of value. And the third thing that we talk about, which is the impact it has on their relationships, like how can it not?
Yeah, and I wonder how much that impacts music and how it sounds a lot alike. It's maybe mimetic isomorphism, drawing inward towards a common sound in order to become popular, although that always doesn't create success either.
Right. And there's been some interesting papers that have kind of been written on that, you know, this idea of like simplicity sells. Persino, Klimek and Ferner, 2014 paper. You also have this kind of increased kind of conventionalism in music that's produced. There was a paper by Serra in 2012, which talked about that as well. There's things being written on that for sure.
And then maybe a final question from our lineup here is, what is the significance of family support for the musician's career? We talk about maybe how they're self-made in this meritocracy illusion, but we know that it's not solely their own efforts that create popularity in musicians and their music. What role does the family play?
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge one. And this is the kind of, I guess this is the third finding really of the book, which is about how the kind of social world of musicians is implicated in this kind of increased levels of anxiety and depression that we found in the kind of survey and the musicians that we spoke to. So in terms of the family relationships, it's a really, really interesting one. one of the things we found when we were speaking to people is, like, of course, it's there's a certain sense in which your success, whatever that success is, as we've mentioned, is reliant on this kind of social infrastructure that you have. But many of the people that we spoke to talked about a kind of tension of having to rely on this kindness and support of others, because it was kind of seen through the prism of kind of guilt. You know, it was kind of more than one should expect, or it kind of comes at this price. You had people that we spoke to say things like, you know, I don't want to be a kind of, I don't want to be broke all the time and be like scrounging off my girlfriend, and she has to pay for our holidays that we go on all this time. And you could really hear people struggling with that. And similarly, the impact it could have on their marriages. We had a really interesting interviewee who kind of described his musical career as like having a third person in their marriage, or a third person in their relationship, but that it was kind of reliant on those people, but impacted the relationship that people had with them. Right. So there's a certain paradox between being told that everyone's got an equal opportunity to succeed in music and the reality that actually that success depends on a certain level of social privilege, I suppose is the word, and kind of networked relationships of power. And that has specific implications for the psychological well-being of individuals and their relationships with others, because they're trying to reconcile that reality. So successes are not isolated incidences of kind of geniuses rising to the top, right? They're embedded not only in the kind of commerciality of the music industries and the industry infrastructures, but also in the associations of families, of friends, and of the kind of social world. And I mean, what we found is that actually in this environment where you are reliant on where the kind of role of the family needs to be kind of unpacked, basically, and understood in a bit more detail. One of the things that came up a lot is people talked about one of the things that impacted on their families was a kind of collapsing of the work-leisure distinction. Right? This idea that it's kind of increasingly difficult to work out like when you're at work and when you're not. That's one of the things we've talked about, right? That in the status of work, that it's difficult to work out when you're working and when you're not. And what is really interesting here is that you get this kind of really intense destabilizing process where there are a number of factors that all are occurring at the same time, which kind of damage the relationships that people have, whether with their family or with others. So you have the financial precarity, which we've talked about. We have the difficulty in defining what work is, which we've talked about. We've talked about a kind of entrepreneurial competitive individualism, which says that, like, it's all on you. The control is in your hand. You have this kind of meritocratic idea that everyone's got an equal chance of winning. And you have a massive reluctance to ever give up and, you know, to stop making music, because it's the prism through which people define your life. You know, the question is, if you're symbolically and practically self-actualizing in a kind of process of entrepreneurship where you're always working and never working, where, you know, great success can be just around the corner, and where the emotional cost of stopping is so enormous, the question is, like, when do you stop? When do you stop working in this way? And so the way in which it comes to impact, not only is it reliant on those family networks, which you asked about, but it also then can come to, I'm reticent to use the word damage, but it can certainly come to impact on them. I mean, one of the ways we explore the ways that it impacts on them is we use this analogy of thinking about musical ambition as being akin to a gambling addiction. So whilst we don't say like having a musical career is like having a gambling addiction, what we say is that if we use a gambling addiction as a way of thinking about it, this helps us to understand how it can be quite damaging. So you always hear people say things like, oh, it's a gamble, you know, you've got to take risks and all this sort of stuff. And of course, the cultural economics that talks about the nature of marketing products in this way understands the nature of those risks. And people have talked about marketing music as being like a gamble. But what we did in the book is we took the DSM-5 and the way in which it defines a gambling addiction. And they basically said that you could suggest that a gambling addiction could be diagnosed if 4 out of the following 9 characteristics were observed. And what we said was, if you replace the word like when I say the word gamble or gambling, if you change that word to make music or making music, there are some really striking parallels. I mean, I can read you some of these factors. So restless or irritable when trying to cut down or stop gambling. Frequent thoughts about gambling, such as reliving past gambling experiences, planning the next gambling venture, or thinking of ways to get money to gamble. Gambling when feeling distressed. After losing money when gambling, returning to get even. Jeopardizing a significant relationship or career opportunity because of gambling. Relying on others to help with money problems caused by gambling. The parallels with changing the word gambling to music making are really, really profound. And what we try and do is to try and look at the ways in which this kind of musical labor, where what you are producing is kind of content and data or whatever, can have quite damaging outcomes for the people, for the relationships that people have around you. And it's just particularly stark to do that for work, which brings the people that we spoke to and interviewed like so much joy. You know, it's like a source of so much pleasure and fulfillment and joy in their lives and brings so much joy and meaning to others. And what we are, I suppose, trying to do is to try and to say, like, this kind of work like matters and is meaningful both to the people that make it and to other people. It's special and it's important and it defines so much of our lives. And yet, look at what it does to the people that make it. That's basically, in the simplest terms, that's kind of what we're doing in this book and saying, let's think about ways that we can live better doing this, because this isn't right. Like, something isn't right about this.
Yes, particularly in careers that are made out of music and unequal opportunities to get into those positions. But even once in that position, some careers falling out of nowhere and people ending up impoverished as a result of their music career falling dead overnight, basically.
Yeah. We refer to this as this kind of process of kind of, they call it deification and demolish, right? This fact that these careers are in the same way that kind of athletes' careers are, you know, there are actually some interesting parallels to like athletes that we talk about in the book, like this literature, which talks about kind of perfectionism amongst musicians and perfectionism amongst athletes and stuff, the way that it kind of, can appear, it actually kind of appears to come and go very quickly, because whilst it looks to average listeners to come very quickly, often hidden behind those stories of kind of overnight success is kind of 10 years of work. It's just that nobody has kind of seen that, but it kind of appears to come and go very quickly. But yeah, if you're not kind of what's being discussed at the kind of, you know, in the UK, it's very much the case, what it used to hold very, very significant power, I would argue it still holds very significant power, is like BBC Radio One. You know, you want your music, you know, playlisted on BBC Radio One. Well, if BBC Radio 1 decide that, you know, we're not into like rappers now, guitar bands are back in fashion, or, you know, that's completely changed. The infrastructure of how you situate yourself has completely changed. And so it can appear, like you say, to come and go very quickly. It's an extremely changeable and kind of just, I mean, the word is really like precarious. I mean, it's a precarious kind of work. But what we're doing in the book is to say, like, yes, there's lots of literature, kind of sociological and otherwise, that's looked at this idea of precarity, you know, what precarity is, how we can, you know, and going back to kind of when Guy Standing introduced the term of the kind of precariat. What we're doing here is really building on an idea which actually Guy Standing mentions, but he doesn't really draw on hugely. Guy Standing introduced this idea of the precariatized mind. I just think that's a really interesting and helpful concept. He talks about that as being a psychological state that's brought about as a consequence of that precarious work. So heightened levels of anger, anxiety, alienation. He draws on Durkheim and his discussion of anime. And that's really what we're looking at, is like, can we expand the way in which we understand the notion of precarity and precariousness and say that it is not only a kind of economic workplace dimension, there's a psychological dimension to this too.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today, Dr. Musgrave. We're all out of time, but I have one final question. What are you working on now?
So both myself and Sally are actually working on a follow-up project to this with a neuropsychologist at the University of Westminster. It's called Catherine Loveday. And we're working on a kind of follow-up project there to explore some of the things we've done in this book using some clinical measures of anxiety and depression with a kind of clinician who has some kind of expertise in that area, or a clinical psychologist, sorry, as opposed to a clinician. So that's going to be really interesting. We're just writing up some of the findings of that at the moment. And I've got some forthcoming papers that are going to be coming out in the next couple of months that draw on a kind of wide variety of factors kind of related to this, including ethical decision making in the music industry. And hopefully I'm probably going to be thinking about what we've written here tells us about what's going on with COVID-19, because obviously we were writing this and then COVID happened and we thought, oh God, do we need to write a whole nother book? But in fact, I think COVID has just amplified and exaggerated and made more brutally acute lots of the things we're discussing in the book. So I think there's interesting resonances for what's happening now. So there's more to be done.
Yes, and I look forward to reading your upcoming material, both in papers as well as in your upcoming project, if it turns into a book. I hope you keep in touch and let me know as new work is released.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Again, this is an episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network, and I look forward to talking with you all soon.